High schoolers are busy, but no one's too busy to help fight cancer. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is looking for their next Student Visionaries of the Year. Could that be your child? High schoolers who participate in this 7-week philanthropic leadership development program gain valuable life skills like project management, communication, financial literacy, and entrepreneurship. Forming strong teams behind them, they fundraise for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society in honor of a pediatric blood cancer survivor right in their local community. Most importantly, this campaign is an opportunity for high schoolers to engage in meaningful work within their community and make a real impact on the lives of blood cancer patients and their families. Sound like something your child might be interested in? You can learn more about Student Visionaries of the Year or even nominate a student at lls.org/students. That's lls.org/students.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hello, you must remember this, listeners. What you are about to hear is a new version of our long-lost first episode, titled The Hard Hollywood Life of Kim Novak. For those who don't know, when I started this podcast 10 years ago, it was fully DIY, and in addition to the old-timey radio that I think most people see as the podcast's main reference, I was inspired by two trends from the 90s when I was a teenager. Mixtapes, which were always imperfect and basically existed to illegally distribute music outside of the capitalist structure, and culture jamming, which was an underground art movement that involved appropriating music and iconography from the mainstream in order to comment on it. In the spring of 2014, when I was dreaming up this podcast and trying to figure out how to make it, I never thought I would make money off of it. The most I hoped for was that a few people would listen, and maybe one of them would hire me to write a book or do something else with my ability to research and analyze old movies. So while I knew it was illegal to essentially sample pre-recorded music to create a score for a podcast, I didn't really think that it mattered much because I thought this show would basically be like a basement tape and no one would sue me because it would be clear to everyone that there was no way for me to make money off of it. That changed really quickly when, after just 10 episodes, I was invited to join a podcast network that planned to sell ads. In signing a contract with that network, I had to get my ducks in a row, legally speaking. And so in the late summer of 2014, I sat down to re-edit the 10 episodes I had already released to remove the copyright music that I didn't have the right to use. However, the original GarageBand project file for this episode had become corrupted, and I couldn't easily re-edit it. So that is why, for the past 9.5 years, there has been no episode 1 of You Must Remember This on podcast apps. So for the podcast's 10th anniversary, which is April 2024, I decided to take the time to restore the episode, to preserve as much of the original as I could, while re-recording parts of it so that I could replace copyright music with royalty-free or pod-safe music. What you are about to hear combines elements from the original 2014 episode with new elements inserted in 2024. I resisted the urge to rewrite the original episode extensively, but I did add or alter a word here or there just to try to make sure that I am communicating what I want to communicate, which I was still clearly learning how to do in 2014. Also, I was still learning how to speak into a microphone. As you'll hear, my voice sounds quite different now than it did then. I wanted to leave in as much of the original episode as possible so that you could hear how far I've come over the past decade. As the show turns 10, I don't currently know what its future is going to be, but right now I just want to take a moment to celebrate how far it's come since those weeks in 2014 when I was banging my head against a wall, sometimes literally, trying to make this thing that would tell the world who I was and what I cared about. I hope you enjoy, and thanks so much for your support. And now, the hard Hollywood life of Kim Novak. Welcome to You Must Remember This, a new podcast dedicated to exploring the secret and/or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. I'm your host, Karina Longworth.
You watch the woman resisting being changed back. Now you have a woman who realizes this is a man who's practically unmasking her. But that's the plot side of it. The sex psychological side was when she came back from having her hair made blonde.
Après s'être fait teindre les cheveux
en
blond.
And it wasn't up.
Et ce n'était pas relevé en chignon.
Oui.
This means
ceci voulait dire
she has stripped but won't take her knickers off.
Qu'elle s'est mise à poil mais elle veut pas enlever ses culottes.
That's Alfred Hitchcock talking to François Truffaut about the film which today is widely considered to be both Hitchcock's masterpiece and maybe the greatest Hollywood film of all time, Vertigo.
Vertigo, a feeling of dizziness, a swimming in the head. Figuratively, a state in which all things seem to be engulfed in a whirlpool of terror, as created by Alfred Hitchcock in the story that gives new meaning to the word suspense.
Vertigo starred Jimmy Stewart as a retired detective who becomes obsessed, first with a beautiful, classy, mysterious blonde named Madeline, and then, after Madeline's death, with a shop girl named Judy. He tries to make Judy over into Madeline, without realizing that they were the same person all along. The double role of Madeline, the ultimate Hitchcockian icy blonde fetish object, and Judy, a regular working girl undone by insecurities which are desperate but not unfounded, was played by Kim Novak. It was a personality and identity split with which Novak was pretty familiar. This is how she explained it in an interview with the British Film Institute a few years ago.
I think the role appealed to me because it was the resistance of Judy, who was, in a sense, me, trying to become the Hollywood person, trying to be Madeline, needing to be loved and willing to be made over. Is this it? Is it, you know, will you, if I become her, will you love me? Do you know? You know, and I remember when I played it, it was, I felt absolutely stripped naked, do you know? I felt so vulnerable.
When Vertigo was going into production in 1957, Kim Novak was the biggest star in Hollywood. She was 24 years old, she had only been in Hollywood for 4 years, and her movies were already selling more tickets than John Wayne's, Doris Day's, and Marilyn Monroe's combined. But nobody cared much about Vertigo when it was first released in 1958, and Novak's star started fading soon thereafter. She gave up living in Hollywood in the mid-60s, married a veterinarian and moved to his ranch in Oregon in the mid-70s, and she played her last film role in 1991. She's made appearances at film festivals and tributes and whatnot in the interim, but she had been out of the wider public eye for decades. Until March 2nd, when the 81-year-old Novak presented two awards,
alongside Matthew McConaughey at the Oscars.
You affected a whole generation of men, got them quite animated with your work in Vertigo. Yeah. Now, here's something that I really love about animation. It's whatever they dream up, and they just draw it. There's no limits, there's no boundaries, total freedom, absolutely anything goes.
Yeah, well, they work with unshackled minds. I mean, they've got so much freedom, and it's beautiful to see.
Pure creativity, incredible writing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I got to take a minute just to say that I'm really glad to be here. It's been a long time.
Me too.
As you can hear, in the room at the Dolby Theater, Novak's presence was at least accorded the respect of polite applause. Outside of the room, on the internet, Novak's appearance instigated an explosion of outrage.
But Kim Novak left the Oscars audience in shock as she took the stage with Matthew McConaughey to present Best Animated Short Film and Best Animated Feature Film. The 81-year-old, who's best known for her role in Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 film Vertigo, got most of the attention due to the drastic plastic surgery she's had in recent years. Her plumped-up cheeks, stretched lips, and high brows caused a stir on social media.
The impulse to attack Novak's apparently visibly altered face was awful and instant. But it was followed by a Leave Kim Novak Alone backlash that was arguably more powerful. Of all of the defenses of Novak's plight as an octogenarian former sex symbol, maybe the most notable and sympathetic came from Farin Neme, who blogs as the self-styled siren. Neme tried to hypothesize what it might feel like to be 81-year-old Novak approaching this situation. She wrote,
"As the evening approaches, the anxiety sets in. Harsh lights, you think, high-definition cameras, and a public that remembers you chiefly as the ice goddess whose beauty once drove James Stewart to the brink of madness. So a few weeks before the ceremony, you go to a doctor, and he says, 'Relax, honey. I have just the thing to make you feel fresh and dewy for the cameras.' And you go to the Oscars, and the next day, you wake up to a bunch of cheap, goddamn shots about your face."
Some aspects of what happened here were unique to our moment, right? The frenzied speed at which Novak's face was eviscerated, the lightning quick pace at which said evisceration was then spun into clickbait, and then the second wave of content in defense of Novak, either shaming her shamers for argument's sake or, like Farin's piece, actually offering humanizing context. These are all products of the technology we have right this second and of how we use them now. But the essence of what happened here was as old school as it gets. And it's the type of thing that's been happening to Novak, on screen and off, for 60 years. Join us, won't you, as we take a look back at the hard Hollywood life of Kim Novak. The future Kim Novak was born Marilyn Novak in 1933 in Chicago. A teenage model, Novak entered a few beauty contests, but she was hardly eyes on the prize about it. She worked all manner of after-school odd jobs, dental assistant, dime store clerk, elevator operator. When she was 20, she earned the role of Miss Deep Freeze and embarked on a national tour, posing with refrigerators. The last stop was San Francisco. And the night before Novak was supposed to hop a train back east, a fellow model convinced Novak to come with her to Los Angeles for some R&R. When they had blown the $500 they had each saved seductively opening iceboxes, then they could go back to frozen Chicago. They had one goal: to swim in the Beverly Hills Hotel pool. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth.
With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/remember. netsuite.com/remember. netsuite.com/remember.
Calling all pop culture enthusiasts.
Are you obsessed with all things celebrity?
Do you live for the drama, the laughs, and the unexpected moments that unfold on social media?
Then you're going to want to tune in to the Comments by Celebs podcast.
Join us three times a week as we deep dive into every aspect of pop culture.
Whether it's dissecting the latest trends or just chatting about your favorite celebs, Comments by Celebs has you covered.
We have new episodes out every week. Follow and listen to Comments by Celebs on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
After about a month of lounging in the sun, the model friend did indeed go home. But Marilyn Novak stayed behind. She signed up with a local modeling agency, and they regularly found work for her as a movie extra, despite the fact that she was, as they frequently reminded her, carrying an extra 25 pounds. Marilyn Novak's big break came on the set of a Jane Russell film, The French Line. Jane Russell was a big star. Literally, she was physically larger than the norm at the time, and the makers of The French Line worried that she looked particularly giant, working it in front of a line of typically petite chorus girls. So director Lloyd Bacon issued a call for plumper potential background girls, and Marilyn Novak got the job. On set, she was spotted by Whit Melnick, a big shot agent, who told her that if she could only lose those 25 pounds, she could start making some real money in the movies. Like, even $30 a week. She did lose some weight, but she didn't pursue Melnick's offer. She wasn't that interested in being a star. She really thought she was just biding her time until some guy came along and married her and took her back to the Midwest and made a mom out of her. Melnick and a Columbia exec named Max Arnau had to almost force her to do a screen test. The test was directed by Richard Quine, who would later direct Novak in Bell, Book, and Candle. The two were engaged for a while, but never married. Quine made Novak do the test while wearing an old strapless dress that had been worn in the movie Gilda by Rita Hayworth. The Columbia star, whose refusal to work had created the vacancy for which Novak was being considered. Novak signed with Columbia in 1953, virtually the last of the contract stars. Harry Cohn was the head of the studio, and it wasn't an exaggeration to compare him to a dictator. In fact, legend has it, he kept a framed photo on his desk of Mussolini. Harry Cohn made Marilyn change her name because in the branding universe of Hollywood, there couldn't be two Marilyns. So, right from the start, she had to become someone different in order to stand out on her own. Cohn wanted to transform Marilyn Novak into someone called Kit Marlowe. The actress's first act of defiance was to resist this, to insist on keeping her family name, and to refuse to take on a first name meant to evoke a kitten. Here is a clip from The Legend of Lila Clare, a 1968 film in which Kim starred as an actress who a tyrannical director, played by Peter Finch, tries to mold in the image of the doomed star she's been cast to play.
Thank you, but I'm happy with the name I have.
Well, I'm not, and neither will the public be. Anyway, what's in a name? Why are you so sensitive?
But she wasn't able to stop the studio from changing her look. Her weight was a constant battle. "That fat Pollock," Cohn called her. even though he knew fully well that Novak was of Czechoslovakian descent. Her teeth were capped, and her hair was bleached and rinsed lavender. A publicist had come up with the idea while flipping through Vogue, declaring that Novak's life would be shaped into a mauve symphony. All this embellishment and transformation made Novak understandably paranoid about her looks. She'd often hide in her trailer, paralyzed by the fear that her hair and makeup weren't quite right or ready. It didn't help matters that Harry Cohn controlled his property, i.e. his stars, through threats, frequently reminding his on-camera chattel that he made them and he could break them. Stars were taught to fear what would happen if they stepped out of line. As they were being put on pedestals in public, behind the scenes they were cut down to size. Their confidence eroded until they believed that they needed the support of the studio just to hold on to whatever security they had in the world, that they could barely live, let alone thrive, on their own. We see this dynamic mirrored in this clip from The Legend of Lila Clare.
What am I supposed to feel?
Feel, you stupid cow! All you've got to do as I say, and then your feeling will be up on the screen. All I need is your face. I don't want your goodwill or your understanding.
It's harder to control someone through intimidation and by hitting them in their inferiority complexes once they've become a hot commodity. Within 3 years of arriving in Hollywood, Kim Novak had become the hottest commodity. It was a 1-2-3 punch that did the job. She helped Frank Sinatra kick heroin in The Man with the Golden Arm. She danced in lust-zonked, post-war conformity-smashing bliss with William Holden in Picnic. And in the musical Pal Joey, she played the good girl side of a virgin whore triangle with gold digger Sinatra and stripper-turned-society matron Rita Hayworth. Hayworth was 39. Her face was already showing the impact of alcoholism, and she was trying to mount a post-third divorce comeback. She was also, of course, the star Novak had been recruited to replace. Think of Pal Joey as the moment when the torch is passed from one generation of stars, Hayworth's, to the next, Novak's. Unfortunately, Novak wouldn't be able to hold on to the torch for very long. But it was good while it lasted. Across this run, Novak's movies earned exponentially more than what they had cost to make. And she became so valuable to Harry Cohn and Columbia that they were forced to overlook it when she would say something a little too candid in the press, or perhaps go out at night with what they perceived as the wrong kind of guy. What's to account for Novak's sudden, massive popularity? What was she broadcasting in the mid to late 50s that audiences so fervently responded to? Here again is Farron Smith Neme.
It's strange because she didn't have like a sort of like sharply defined personality, like Shirley MacLaine being, you know, kind of kooky, or Marilyn's like sort of, you know, vulnerability coupled with the dumb blonde image that she was kind of shackled to, or Grace Kelly being the epitome of high class. Novak was almost kind of defined by what she wasn't. She wasn't really like any of those.
Novak brought something unique to the screen. She was the master of the almost blank, enigmatic stare. Maybe it's crazy hyperbolic to call Novak the female James Dean, but there's something to the comparison. There's a real angst to her screen presence, a kind of petulant pain that you don't get from many actresses of her day. Just as Dean's 3-screen performances, when taken together, encapsulate something tangible about being a young man in the 1950s, so too do Novak's handful of really interesting performances give face and body to the repressed agony of being a young woman in the 50s.
There's something very 50s about Novak because the surface is incredible, but you get a sense that there's a facade, and that feels very kind of Eisenhower, doesn't it? You've got this perfect surface, and then in back there's just this mess of things that need to be worked on.
She may have been molded after Marilyn and groomed to replace Rita, but unlike the pinups that preceded her, Kim Novak rarely seemed to be having fun with her sexuality. If anything, she made being stuck in a beautiful body seem like an unconscionable burden. Of course, a lot of that had to do with what she was asked to do. In each of her three big hits between 1955 and 1957, Novak played a gold-hearted bombshell whose outsized sexual appeal causes some kind of panic. But these girl women are hardly in control of their powers. In fact, they're all wounded birds enthralled to charismatic bad news boyfriends. Sinatra's golden arm junkie and pal Joey Hustler, William Holden's chiseled vagabond, whose presence at a small town picnic inspires hysteria. Novak's characters clung to these damaged bachelors as though they had absolutely no other options. And maybe they didn't. Over and over again, Novak's characters are told their beauty and their bodies are their only sources of value. And then they're humiliated for trying to assert any kind of ownership over these assets. One example is this scene from Picnic, in which Novak, playing 19-year-old small-town beauty Madge, is pressured by her mom into using her feminine wiles to land a rich husband, whether she likes him or not.
When a girl's as pretty as you are, she doesn't have a mom.
What good is it just to be pretty?
What a question.
Maybe I get tired of only being looked at.
You puzzle me when you talk that way. Madge, does Alan never make love?
Sometimes we park the car by the river.
Do you let him kiss you?
Well, after all, you've been going together all summer. Of course I let him.
Does he ever want to go beyond kissing?
Oh, Mom.
Well, I'm your mother, for heaven's sakes. These things have to be talked about. Do you like it when he kisses you?
Yes.
You don't sound very enthusiastic.
Well, what do you expect me to do? Pass out every time Alan puts his arms around me?
No, you don't have to pass out. But there won't be many more opportunities like the picnic tonight, and it seems to me you could at least...
What?
Oh, nothing. Nothing.
The clear implication from the mom is that the daughter should put out so as to assure this rich guy that she's the kind of girl who will be compliant to whatever he wants. In her own personal life, Novak was also expected to at least pretend to be a certain type of girl and only be seen with the right types of men. But by 1957, she was so fed up with all the rules imposed on her that she either stopped caring about conformity or actively chose to rebel against it.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
At a party at Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh's house that year, Kim Novak met Sammy Davis Jr. At that time, 3 years after the car accident in which he lost his left eye, Sammy had already triumphed on Broadway in Mr. Wonderful, but the Rat Pack wasn't really a thing yet, and an unquestionably racist Hollywood, real movie stardom was proving elusive. Both Kim and Sammy struggled to conform to what was expected of them based on how they looked, and both felt like outsiders on the inside. The two were instantly attracted to one another and spent the whole night deep in one-on-one conversation. The next day, after their meeting had made the tabloid news, Sammy called Kim to apologize. He knew the very idea that Novak had allowed herself to be chatted up by a black man in public would send Harry Cohn into fits. "The studio doesn't own me," Kim responded, and invited Sammy over to her place for dinner. So began a series of clandestine dates.
The two eventually rented a house in Malibu for their rendezvous, but they couldn't be too careful. Sammy would lie on the floor of his chauffeured car, covered up by a blanket, so that no one could see him in transit and connect him to Novak. And this wasn't pure paranoia. From the moment Kim signed her contract with Columbia, they had had private detectives on her tail. Kim Novak was playing out this duplicitous chapter in her private life during the back half of 1957, the same time that she was making Vertigo. Novak has always said that she had a special connection to the material. Maybe she was uniquely inspired by the Vertigo script to start taking back her own identity. Maybe she was emboldened by the secret she was keeping in her personal life. Regardless, Kim Novak chose this moment to start fighting back against the controls of the studio. In September of 57, Novak famously held up the start of production on Vertigo, refusing to show up to work until Harry Cohn at Columbia negotiated her contract. It was a huge gamble, and it paid off. The studio caved, and despite a brief skirmish over her wardrobe, Novak initially resisted wearing the black spike heels and form-fitting gray suit that Hitchcock had transposed into the script directly from his own fantasies. The making of Vertigo was, by Hitchcock standards, relatively painless. The trouble was soon to come. Novak's work on the movie was done by December 1957, and she went home to Chicago to spend Christmas with her parents. By that point, the relationship with Sammy had apparently hit levels of delirium.
At least for him. Booked to do a series of shows at the Sands in Las Vegas, one night Sammy told the casino they'd have to find a replacement. And then he hopped on a red-eye to Chicago, determined to meet Kim's parents and ask for their daughter's hand in marriage. He was barely on the ground in Chicago before he had to turn around and fly right back so as to be in Vegas for that night's show. It was totally nuts, the kind of love-struck madness that only happens in movies. And, apparently, to people who make movies. And it backfired. Reporters in Vegas noted Sammy's absence and put two and two together. Soon word reached Harry Cohn in New York of the impending scandal about to break in magazines like Confidential. Cohn called his assistant, Max Arnau, in L.A. to inform him they had a disaster on their hands. The damage control process began, but Cohn and Columbia weren't able to move fast enough. 2 hours later, the first blind item about an affair between a certain K.N. and S.D. hit the New York papers. Harry Cohn had his first heart attack the next morning. Over the next weeks, gossips dispensed with the discretion. Kim Novak is about to become engaged to Sammy Davis Jr., and Hollywood is aghast, announced the London Daily Mirror. Confidential called it the tragic love story of the century and claimed Frank Sinatra had told his friend and Vegas co-star, "Sammy, you're making a serious mistake." At this point, enough was enough. Legend has it that Harry Cohn hired gangsters to drive Sammy Davis Jr. out into the desert. Not to seriously hurt the guy, just to put the fear into him, so he got the message that the Novak affair had to be called off. But Sammy had mob ties of his own, who could keep him safe as long as he stayed in Vegas. Eventually, Cohn's mobsters and Davis's mobsters worked out a deal. Since the only surefire way to kill the story was to change the subject, Sammy would have to marry someone else. He'd have to give up the beautiful blonde top box office draw in Hollywood and hook up with someone more appropriate. So someone like Lorrae White, a single mom and chorus girl whom Davis had dated a couple of times. No one was under any illusions that this was romantic matrimony. White signed a contract stipulating a $25,000 rate for 1 year of marriage. The scandal was thus put to bed, but on some significant level, the principals never recovered. Sammy Davis went to his deathbed vowing that Kim Novak had been the love of his life. Harry Cohn's wife believed the scandal killed him. 2 months after the heart attack he suffered amidst the first gossip reports, he was dead. Novak quickly bounced back in her romantic life. In fact, the promotion of Vertigo was marred by a scandal involving the gifts she allegedly received from her alleged new boyfriend, the son of the Prime Minister of the Dominican Republic. But without Cohn around to guide her selection of roles, she struggled. Vertigo's lackluster box office performance broke Novak's lucky streak. Aside from Richard Kind's Strangers When We Meet and Billy Wilder's fascinatingly vulgar Kiss Me Stupid, in which Kim starred opposite one of Sammy's Rat Pack cronies, Dean Martin, the next few years brought on a string of duds.
Then, in 1966, Kim Novak's L.A. home was endangered by mudslides. She managed to fill a station wagon with some valuables, furniture, and paintings, and she was taking a final armful of things to the car when she looked up and saw that journalists were starting to gather in her driveway. A handful of newspaper men, a truck from NBC. Shocked by their presence, she dropped a sculpture, which smashed to the ground. Her eyes swelled with tears, and according to one of her biographers, right then and there she vowed, "I'm getting out of Hollywood, and I won't come back, ever."
Days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
She did leave Los Angeles, moving first to Big Sur, and then, after marrying veterinarian Bob Malloy in 1976, up to his ranch in Oregon. It took her another 25 years to officially stop working, although there's not much on her filmography of note after 1968, when she starred in Robert Aldrich's totally loony The Legend of Lila Clare. A kind of End of the Hays Code exploitation thriller come camp remake of Vertigo, Lila Clare cast Novak as a mousy girl who's essentially forced to star in a megalomaniac director's movie as the dead, Marlena Dietrich-esque, bisexual star whom he loved and whom she resembles. The Legend of Lila Clare has been virtually forgotten, and maybe for good reason, although, once again, it gave Novak a chance to rehearse her own real-life struggles to assert herself in an industry that routinely dehumanized her. Here's another clip from The Legend of Lila Clare, in which dialogue between Novak's actress and Finch's director doubles as an encapsulation of what Kim herself had experienced in the studio system.
Who are you?
I'm somebody that you wanted to make love to. Some people might think that had a certain amount of responsibility.
Oh, would they? You don't own me. You don't control me. On the contrary, you be on the set at 9 o'clock in the morning and do exactly as I say because you're an illusion. Without me, you don't exist. You're nothing. Do you understand? Nothing.
If the question sparked by the 2014 Oscars was, what happened to Kim Novak? Well, here's what we know. She worked the tribute circuit in the late 90s when Vertigo was restored and re-released, and then largely slipped out of the public eye for the next 15 years, popping up for the occasional interview or film festival. In 2006, she had a serious horse riding accident, suffering broken ribs, a punctured lung, and nerve damage. Then, 4 years later, she was diagnosed with breast cancer. In 2012, she appeared on stage a few doors down from the Dolby Theater in a conversation with Robert Osborne that was later aired on TCM.
In that conversation, she admitted to having been diagnosed as bipolar and cried talking about the production of her final film, Liebstrom, directed by Mike Figgis. It's possible some of her changed appearance could owe to these very real health problems. It's also possible that after an entire life of being told that she had to be made over in order to be accepted in Hollywood, she internalized the mandate to transform herself. We all know defying nature is a slippery slope. We learned it from the movies.
Any reminder of your imperfections just gets magnified in your brain. And I had always found that really sympathetic about Kim Novak. And so, you know, especially the day after the Oscars, I was so indignant that people were going after her about that. I was like, no, don't you know that she's always been insecure?
After she wrote her blog post on Novak, Farron was tipped off by a reader, the writer Dan Callahan, to an interview Novak had given a few months earlier, in which she acknowledged that she had gone to see a plastic surgeon and regretted it.
She wanted a fresh look, but, quote, I didn't want to do anything major, end quote. A doctor suggested fat injections to add fullness to her face. She said, that was absolutely crazy when I think about it now. You spend all your time trying to get rid of fat. I love the hollow kind of cheekbone look, Novak says. So why did I do it? I trusted somebody doing what I thought they knew how to do best. I should have known better. But what do? We do some stupid things in our lives. I mean, you pay to look worse. You pay money for that.
We know Hollywood is a tough place for aging actresses. We know most of them end up doing something artificial in order to stall the aging process or to foster the illusion of eternal youth and beauty. So why did Novak's altered appearance cause such an uproar? Maybe it's because her whole career seems to have been defined by that push and pull between wanting to be appreciated for who she was, for herself, and the pressure to conform to an imaginary ideal, or just straight up transform into someone else. Or maybe it's because it seems to go against the one thing that, at her peak in the 1950s, really made Novak stand out.
On the one hand, she's got this very dramatic beauty, but she doesn't feel... I watch Audrey Hepburn and Grace Kelly, who are also big stars in that period, or even Sophia Loren, and they're so beyond, like, mortal women. But you look at Kim Novak, and there's something relatable about her. It's a rare quality in a screen beauty where you look at her and you think there's a reality to this woman and to the way she's dealing with her beauty.
One final note. While Novak has frequently acknowledged that Harry Cohn forbid her from being seen with Sammy Davis Jr., she's never publicly acknowledged that her close friendship with Sammy, as she's called it, was sexual. Maybe the sheer fact that we expect famous women to disclose details of their sex lives is part of the problem.
Thanks for listening to You Must Remember This. This week's guest stars included Farron Nemeh, who blogs at selfstyledsiren.blogspot.com. Join us next time for another story from the secret and or forgotten histories of Hollywood's first century. I'm Karina Longworth. Good night.
You must remember a kiss is just a kiss. A smile was for sale.